My most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and coming to you live from our studios at the Shri Sathya Sai Media Center, Prashanthi Nilayam. I'm delighted to join you again on this program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita week after week, and I've had the pleasure of your company for over 130 episodes, and we are right now going through the 10th chapter, the Vibhuti Yoga, as it is named, and we are in the middle of the chapter, we could say. Before we go into what we have for this week, the shlokas, I think we will be covering quite a few shlokas today, because much of the shlokas are what Arjuna is saying as a question. He's phrasing a question, and also he's summarizing whatever he has understood from what Krishna has said thus far. So many of those words that he uses, statements that he makes, are repetition of what we have already covered. So I will very briefly be making references to what we've covered already, and we will cover more verses a little more quickly this time. So we will, as always, start with a short summary of what we did last week. We covered three shlokas last week, shloka numbers 8, 9 and 10. In the 8th verse, Krishna said, Aham sarvasya prabhavah, I am the source of all, mattah sarvam pravartate, and from me everything flows, or from it is by me that everything is sustained. And he goes on to say that whoever understands this, that I am the source of everything, and everything sustains and everything revolves because of me, and worships me with devotion. The moment you are aware of this, you automatically begin to look upon him with awe and with love. Such a person is only worthy of being called Buddha, or the wise one. The importance of what Krishna is saying here, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavah, is till now Krishna spoke about the various vibhutis or expressions of his glories through which he can be recognized and worshipped. But one's worship should not stop there, as we've seen multiple times in the previous shlokas and previous chapters. From recognizing him through these manifestations, you must also recognize him as the source of everything, not merely those manifestations. And that is why Aham Sarvasya Prabhavah is a very important acknowledgement that a devotee makes. The 9th shloka was a very beautiful one, where Krishna states, how do such people lead their lives? Those that were described in the previous shloka and before that too. He goes on to further describe them as Machittaha, those whose minds are wholly absorbed in me, Machittaha. Then he says, Matgata Pranaha, those whose life is centered on me, or who look upon me as being dearer than their very life. So such people, Machittaha, Matgata Pranaha, how do they lead their life? Bodhayantaha Parasparam Kathayantaha Mam Nityam. A very beautiful statement. They share their feelings with each other, bodhayantaha parasparam, amongst themselves. Kathayantaha, they speak descriptively about me, or they share stories about me. Kathayantaha chamam nityam, and they share such stories about me constantly, all the time. And why do they do that? Why do they constantly engage in such exchange? Tushyanti cha ramanti. Because that is what gives them joy and satisfaction. As we discussed, only when you have internal satisfaction, something that is outside can give joy. When the thoughts of God give satisfaction to the devotees seek outside such activities and such company that lead to that internal fulfillment, isn't it? And that they are able to experience through sharing their learning, bodhayantaha parasparam, and by sharing their experiences and their understandings descriptively, kathayantaha chamam nityam. In the 10th verse, Krishna declares, tesham satatayuktanam bhajatam pritipurvakam, to those who are always devout and who worship me with love this way, dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. I confer upon them buddhi yoga, which eventually leads them to me. Mam upayanti te. As we discussed, Krishna had said right in the beginning that it is buddhi yoga, or this ability to look at things through this spiritual intellect, that is what was described as buddhi yoga by Krishna right in the second or third chapter itself. So Krishna had said this buddhi yoga is that which makes a person a karma yogi, which eventually leads him to the state of a jnani. And here Krishna is saying that who worships me in this manner, I confer upon them this buddhi yoga. And we also saw how that 10th shloka is very similar to the Ananyas Chintayantoma shloka, the 22nd shloka of the previous chapter. And the shlokas that are going to follow, or at least the next shloka, Krishna is going to further describe how this process happens. How does he confer this buddhi yoga? So we'll dive right into it. We'll listen to the 11th verse, as always, beautifully and clearly rendered by Brother Shyam, one of my seniors and one of our volunteers. We'll listen to the shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And then we'll discuss in detail what Krishna is stating here.
Teshamevanukampartham Ahamajnanajam tamaha Nashayamyatmabhavastho Jnanadeepena bhasvata.
Out of compassion for them alone, I, abiding in their mental activity as its object, dispel the darkness born of ignorance by the brilliant lamp of knowledge. So that is the 11th verse of the 10th chapter. As we were just discussing in the summary, in the previous verse, Krishna said that those devoted to him will be granted buddhi yoga and eventually will be led to him. That same point is being elaborated in this verse. From what we've discussed in the Gita so far, it is very clear that there are two ways of looking at God, right? There is no right or wrong way, because both these approaches are only relative and both of them are wrong in that sense, because the mind is incapable of comprehending God, and however you think of him, whatever you think of him as, is actually off the mark, right? But thinking of him in a certain way allows you to embark on this journey through which you approach him, right? So one of those ways is that of a devotee, where you look upon God as a master or a beloved, a benefactor, a guru. However it is, you look upon God as a person, right? Only when you concretize God or epitomize God in a person, you can look upon him as all these, as a master or as a guru or whatever it is. The other way of looking at God and comprehending God is the Vedantic approach. You don't look upon God as an entity as such, but as the Adhara, or the foundation on which everything exists, or that Satvastu, as they say, that fundamental building block on which this entire creation is created, right? These are all Vedantic approaches, and even within Vedantic approaches, there are different schools of thought. What you think of Maya, what you think of Purusha, what is the relation between the two? There are various approaches by which you can look upon God, right? Even within that schools of Vedanta. And some of those analogies also we have come across, and we've spoken extensively about the snake and the rope, the pot and the clay, the wave and the ocean. These are all approaches that allow us to move closer to the truth, but none of them are true by themselves, right? As we've discussed before, these are all Vidya Mayas. They are still Mayas, illusions, not really the truth. But these are Vidya Mayas, which means they take us closer to that truth. And in the Gita, Krishna speaks of both of these, and in a sense, he is harmonizing the two approaches, right? That's what we've seen. Second chapter was completely about that absolute Vedanta. Sankhya is that, speaking the truth without mincing any words. But thereafter, slowly, Krishna speaks about the acts of sacrifice, the idea of worship. Now he's speaking about devotion. So in a sense, Krishna is harmonizing these two approaches, and we've spoken about that also much in detail, about how both of these together help us progress on the spiritual journey. Krishna speaks of a devotee as one who focuses on the Lord and for whom God becomes top priority. Mat chittaha mat gata pranaha. If she or he has to choose between pleasing the Lord and the rest of the world, they will always choose to please the Lord. And the decision-making is quite spontaneous. There is no dilemma there. So Krishna is speaking about how he responds to such devotion. So in this shloka and the previous one, he speaks of the process. In the previous one, he said, I grant them buddhi yoga. And here he is further elaborating that in a little more detail. And there is a problem when you speak of the process, right? Whenever you speak of a process, there is a small paradox there. I will come to that shortly. But first, let's see what Krishna is stating in the shloka. Krishna states, Tesham, for them, eva anukampartham, merely out of compassion, aham, I, ajnanajam tamaha. The darkness, tamaha means darkness, ajnanajam means born out of ajnana. So ajnanajam tamaha, the darkness born of ignorance, nashayami, I destroy the darkness of ignorance, and I do that out of my compassion, Krishna says. Atma bhavastaha, dwelling within their self or in their mind. Jnana deepena bhasvata, as the luminous lamp of knowledge. So there are a few things that Krishna is saying here that we must spend some time in, and also the paradox that I just made a mention of. Firstly, this point that he does this out of compassion. That is where I think we have a slight issue with that. When we talk of a process, whenever you say that this is the process involved in anything, in any of the mechanisms, right? We talk of a mechanism that is involved in getting from place A to place B, or receiving something or attaining something. The moment you say that this is a process, this is a mechanism, then you're speaking about something that is not subjective, isn't it? It doesn't depend on who is interacting with that system. When you say that this is the process to, say, obtain a driver's license or a passport or to get a degree, it means it does not matter who you are, where you come from, what you do for a living. If you fulfill the criteria and follow the process, you are given the license or the passport or whatever it is. So there is no compassion involved here. And in fact, Krishna had said, the person may be anyone. Krishna said in the 9th chapter, if you recall, Samoham sarvabhuteshu name dveshyosti na priyaha. I am the same to all beings, I favor none, I hate none. Then he said, even a sudurachara, a perfectly bad person, if he follows this process, reaches me. So these are all statements that are indicative of the non-subjective nature of this whole process. You could be the worst person, but if you follow this process, you will reach me, right? That's what Krishna himself has said. And he says, I do not favor between a good person and a bad person. I don't have any likes and dislikes. So when you follow this process, there is no favoritism. When that is the case, when we take the example of the government documents that I just spoke of, we look at the officer at each step and say that, you know, this is the criteria that I need to fulfill. I fulfill that. And you give me the form, you accept the payment, and you grant the document. There is no compassion involved in this. You will not look at the officer and say that out of your compassion that you're sanctioning my application. You did what was necessary, and that person on the other side of the counter did his or her duty, isn't it? Then where is the question of compassion or sympathy when we talk about a non-subjective process? I will try and explain how I see it, because the fact is Krishna is saying I do that out of my compassion, and I am nobody to say that that's not right or that's not true. Krishna said that this is a non-subjective process. Now Krishna is saying that I do it out of my compassion. So I think what our duty is to try and understand why he is saying both. So I will try to explain how I see it. It may or may not be the right explanation, but I'm just sharing it with you based on how it occurred to me. One way of seeing it is, the overall process is itself a result of his compassion. There is a rigorous means of releasing oneself from the cycle of birth and death, what we spoke of before as karma mukti, right? Gradually and painstakingly, you move through these various lokas and you're liberated and you spend thousands of years in each one of these lokas. It's a very slow and definitely a sure process, but it's a very slow process. So Krishna says, out of my compassion, I am giving you an easier path. I am making things simpler for you. Just like an authority who looks at a cumbersome process, for some government document, and people are struggling with it, and there are innumerable steps in the process where you could go wrong, and it leads to enormous amount of difficulty for the people involved. So the officer who is in charge looks at this whole process and says, okay, I mean, this is not how people should suffer. Let me make it a little simpler. So there is still a process, and that process is not subjective. But the fact that the process was simplified itself could be an expression of compassion or sympathy, isn't it? So that is probably one way of looking at how Krishna is describing this as being done out of his compassion. The other way of looking at it, and I feel it is also a very important one, is that of this idea of superimposition. Again, a topic that we've spoken of before. I don't know how many times I've said this already. Most of what we're discussing has been spoken of before, but it calls for making references every now and then so that the connection is made. So we had spoken about this concept of upasana or worship itself being a form of superimposition. There is an idol. I superimpose the idea of a deity over it and then I worship it. I say pranaya swaha, abhanaya swaha, vyanaya swaha. And what do? I take a few drops of water in my palm and I offer it in front of the altar. So I superimpose the idea of offering my pranas on the simple act of pouring a few drops of water at the feet of the Lord. So there is an act of giving, or you're doing something, but then you are superimposing an idea on it, right? For example, there's an act of charity from the giver, but we speak of having gratitude. You know, there are some acts where there is no act of giving, right? That person is not actually consciously giving, but then we speak of having gratitude to the giver. The best example you can think of is entities of nature. We speak of how the cows and the trees and the rivers, they don't live for themselves, they live for others. Well, they're not consciously doing it. They are living out their life the way they were meant to live. But we superimpose this idea of they, as an act of sacrifice, giving their riches to us, right? And when we superimpose this idea, then our actions and our response to those actions become a little more sensible. When I look at the cow, as some, you know, when I look at the cow, and as Swami would say, one of the important things about Sanatana Dharma is the concept of the five mothers, and one of them is the Gomata. A child is born and brought up drinking the mother's milk, and thereafter it is the cow's milk that the child is given. So the cow has to be given, has to be looked at as the mother. But the way of giving is totally different when you talk of the mother giving, feeding the child versus the cow's milk being given. But we superimpose this idea of the concept of a mother giving milk on this fact, on this act of the cow giving milk. That leads us to look at this animal in a completely different way. We treat the animal differently. We treat what we receive from that animal differently, right? In the same way, if you look at this path of bhakti, this itself is based on the idea of loving God, right? The idea that there is an entity whom, on whom I direct my love and from whom I receive love. So this whole process is based on the ability to think of God with love and think of God as being loving. So I think Krishna says here, I do this out of compassion so that we are able to relate to this idea of a benevolent, loving God. The more we think of the Lord that way, the more we develop devotion, the more we become matchitta madgata prana, isn't it? Those that are always thinking of Him, as He said, as Krishna said, with love, right? Priti purvakam, He says, with love they think of Me. Again, this is not to say that God is not compassionate, right? Here Krishna is saying that I do this out of my compassion, and this fellow is sitting here and saying that no, actually God is not compassionate, it is a non-subjective process. That is not what I'm trying to say here. When we look at the statement of Krishna, anukampartham aham tamaha nashayami, out of compassion I destroy the darkness. We look at it from our idea of a compassionate act. And even that, though it may seem paradoxical, there is merit to it, right? And there is another point about the importance of this love. I'll come to that shortly. But the point here is, when you say that God is doing this out of compassion, you are looking at it from the point of view of your understanding of what is compassion, and that idea of God's compassion is completely different from our idea, right? So that is looking at it as God doing a compassionate act. Now look at it as a process, because as I said in the previous shloka, Krishna said, I give them buddhi yoga and thereby lead them to Me. And in this shloka, He's going to speak about that process a little more elaborately. So let us look at it as a process. Krishna had said, one who worships Me with one-pointedness, I confer buddhi yoga and I help the person reach Me. How does that happen? Atma bhavastaha jnana deepena bhavastva. When you worship Him, he first becomes Atma Bhavastaha, one who resides in your mind. Here, Atma is not used in the sense of the divine Atma, but the self, the smaller self or the mind, right? So, Atma Bhavastaha means one who resides in your mind. The moment you start contemplating on the Lord starts residing in your mind as a thought, right? He starts residing as a concept at least. So when you contemplate on me, Krishna says, when you dedicate all your actions to me, when you endeavor to please me, Krishna says, I become Atma Bhavastaha, the one who is established in the mind. Having God established is like lighting a lamp, from the example that Krishna is giving in the shloka. When you light a lamp, you don't have to then request the lamp to dispel darkness. The lamp brings along with it this nature of effulgence. It is not a two-step process. It's like, I light a lamp and then I tell, oh lamp, please dispel the darkness. No, lighting the lamp, the act itself is the act of dispelling the darkness, isn't it? You cannot separate the lamp and this quality of it bringing effulgence. Similarly, Bhagavan is jnana or wisdom, and jnana is to him what effulgence is to a lamp. So when he becomes Atma Bhavastaha, as Krishna said in the shloka, he is the jnana deepa, the lamp of jnana. Ajnana or ignorance comes from darkness, tamaha. And when he becomes the Atma Bhavastaha, you don't have to ask him to dispel the darkness, because his very nature is where he establishes himself as the jnana deepa, the tama, the darkness that is born out of ajnana, ajnana jamaha, that has to go. Aham nashayami, I destroy tamaha, the darkness, ajnana jam. Ajam means born, ajnanajam, that darkness which is born out of ignorance. Atma bhavastaha jnana deepena bhavastva. Dwelling within your mind as the luminous lamp of knowledge. Aham nashayami, I destroy. That is why I said, it may seem paradoxical to mention compassion. Because this is a process, right? The moment you light a lamp, the lamp dispels the darkness. Can we say that the lamp out of its compassion is dispelling the darkness? No, the lamp is meant for that. The lamp's nature is to give light. Adi Shankara in his commentary for the shloka goes on to describe what is this lamp, right? And that's a very important analogy that he gives. Rather, what is the oil in the lamp and what is the wick? And some of those analogies he gives. And it's very fascinating because whenever Swami would himself speak about this Jnana Deepa or Jnana Jyoti, the lamp of wisdom, Swami would give more or less the same analogy, and it's very beautiful and very instructive as to what this Jnana Deepa is made of. I will probably read out a quote from Swami and then discuss this parallel. Swami says, and this is from a discourse that Swami delivered on November 9th, 1988, Swami says, and I quote, "How is the darkness in the heart to be removed? It can be dispelled only by the light of wisdom, the Jnana Jyoti. How is this light of wisdom, this spiritual light, to be lit? This needs four elements. Detachment or Vairagya is the container. Devotion or bhakti is the oil. One-pointed concentration or ekagrata is the wick. And knowledge of the supreme truth, jnana, is the matchstick." End of quote. The first point is, he says, the container is vairagya and the oil is bhakti. In Sanskrit, the word oil, the word for oil is sneha. And it comes from the adjective sneha, which means sticky, right? So sneha means oil. Sneha as an adjective means that which is sticky. And we all know sneha also means affection or love or friendship, right? It's very interesting that we use the word sneha for affection as well as for something that is sticky, because in the name of affection, we all go through this problem, right? Our affection is sticky. It attaches itself to whoever it is directed towards. The same quality of stickiness or being attached to someone or something it is diverted towards, the same quality of sneha has to be turned towards God. But for that oil or for that sneha to be useful in this manner, it has to be contained in something. I cannot pour oil on a flat surface and try to light a lamp with it. It needs to be contained in something. It needs to be kept in such a manner that it is all kept together and it does not flow in all directions. That container, Swami says, is vairagya or detachment. The more I turn this love or sneha towards God, the more I will become detached towards the world and the people in them. Right? Such a beautiful analogy, isn't it? Sneha oil means attachment. That attachment should be turned towards God. And that is possible when this sneha is contained in this container of vairagya. The more I turn this love to God, the more I become detached towards the word, which means the more I am likely to become one-pointed. Ekagrata, or one-pointedness, is a result of this love that is turned towards God and is contained with vairagya. Right? So the oil is devotion. The container which keeps it all together and so that it doesn't spread in all directions is vairagya. And when there is oil and when there is vairagya, ekagrata or one-pointedness automatically comes. And the matchstick, Swami says, is jnana. In another discourse, Swami says it is tattva jnana, which means this is what we always speak about as paroksha jnana. It is not jnana that has come from oneself, but it is paroksha jnana. It is knowledge that is received from the scriptures or those who have seen it. I am seeing it through somebody else's eyes, right? So here the matchstick is tattva jnana. There needs to be an initiation, and that can come either from the scriptures or from the words of the master. That is why it is paroksha jnana. Someone else has seen it and they are telling me what it is. And using that spark, I light this lamp. And when everything is in place, like the lamp, the oil, the soaked wick and everything, Adi Shankara says, the lamp must be placed in a corner where there is no breeze. And what is that breeze? Raga and dvesha and attraction to the sense objects, the distractions that come from outside. And if all this is in place, the lamp with the oil, the soaked wick in a corner where there is no breeze, and then you have the right matchstick which is able to light that fire, you have illumination instantly. So what is important is this sneha, the oil or affection, right? And that, as we see, is reinforced if we are able to think of the Lord as the compassionate one. Krishna said, I dispel the darkness that is born out of ignorance out of my compassion. Why is it important to look at it as an act of compassion and not merely a non-subjective process? Because the more I look at it as an act of compassion, the more I'm likely to turn my devotion towards him, because that devotion is the oil for this lamp to be illumined, right? At this point, Arjuna begins to raise a few questions. For a very long time, he's been silently listening, and now he starts asking questions. So we will listen to the next shloka, the 12th shloka, and we will see what Arjuna says there, and then we'll discuss about it.
అర్జున ఉవాచ పరం బ్రహ్మ పరం ధామ పవిత్రం పరమం భవాన్ పురుషం శాశ్వతం దివ్యం ఆదిదేవమజం విభుం.
అర్జున సెడ్, థౌ ఆర్ట్ ది సుప్రీం స్పిరిట్, ది ఇటర్నల్ హోమ్, ది సుప్రీం ప్యూరిఫయర్, ది ఇటర్నల్ డివైన్ సెల్ఫ్, ది ట్రాన్సెండెంటల్, ది సోర్స్ ఆఫ్ ఆల్ డెయిటీస్, ది అన్బోర్న్ అండ్ ది ఓమ్నిప్రెసెంట్. So that was the 12th shloka of the 10th chapter. This shloka and the ones to follow may not have much to explain, as I said in the introduction itself, because Arjuna is going to more or less summarize his understanding of what Krishna has said so far. And in the process, he's going to be using some words and adjectives and terms that Krishna has already spoken about. And because Krishna has spoken about it, we have try to understand it in a detailed manner already. So we will go through them a little faster than the previous shlokas. So Arjuna says here, Param Brahma, Supreme Brahman or the Supreme Being, Param Dhamma, the Supreme Abode, the Supreme Home. However far and high a bird flies, it has to come back to its nest, isn't it? We may take a million lifetimes and travel from top to bottom of the 14 lokas, spend multiple lifetimes in each one of them, but our home is always the source. Arjuna acknowledges that. He understands that Krishna is the Param Dhamma, the ultimate supreme abode. Pavitram Paramam Bhavan. Bhavan means thyself, for you. Pavitram Paramam Bhavan. You are the supreme purifier, a topic we have discussed many times before. Jnana alone can remove the idea of doership, and when doership is removed, there is no merit and sin, right? So jnana is like that soap which kind of removes this stain of merit and sin. So that is why it is the supreme purifier. Nothing can purify like jnana, right? So that jnana is the Lord Himself. So that's why Krishna, Arjuna is saying, Pavitram Paramam Bhavan, you are the supreme purifier. Then he says, Purusham Shashvatam, you are the eternal person. Divyam, you are divine. Calling something divine means you're not human. You're beyond my human comprehension. So he says, Divyam. And then he says, Adi Devam, the source of all deities or devas. Ajam, unborn. Vibhum, omnipresent. Right? So all of these are words by now we are quite familiar with, because Krishna has spoken about them and we have also discussed in detail. Arjuna continues whatever he was saying in the next one. We'll listen to the 13th verse as well, and then I'll give you a meaning of that.
Ahustva mrushaya sarve దేవర్షిర్నారదస్తథా అసితో దేవలో వ్యాసః స్వయం చైవ బ్రవీషి మే.
సో హవ్ సెడ్ ది సీయర్స్ ఇన్ ది డివైన్ సేజ్ నారద యాస్ వెల్ యాస్ అసిత దేవల అండ్ వ్యాస అండ్ యూ యోర్ సెల్ఫ్ హవ్ సెడ్ ఇట్ నౌ. That's the 13th verse. As I was saying, Arjuna continues what he was saying in the previous verse. He says, but here he says that this is not merely my observation. There is corroboration for this. He says, Ahuhu Tvam. They declared about you. So all that Arjuna just mentioned are not merely a subjective observation, but is a conclusion that many great thinkers have come to. They all have declared. And who are these people? He says, Rishayah Sarve, all rishis, Deva Rishayah Naradah Tatha, and also the Deva Rishi Narada. Asito Devalo Vyasah. Asita is a sage who is mentioned in some of the Puranas as one of the students of Vyasa. And Devala is a sage born to sage Asita. So Asita is one sage, his son Devala is another sage, and then he mentions Vyasa too. So he says Asita, Devala and Vyasa, Narada and all sages have also made these observations. And not just that, he says Swayam cha eva, even you yourself, Bravishit me, have declared to me. And that is the greatest fortune of Arjuna, right? As Krishna said, even the sages and devas cannot talk about me, so I am speaking about my vibhutis myself. So that's what Arjuna is saying in the previous verse. He referred to Krishna with various appellations. He says, Param Brahmam, Param Dhamam, Pavitram Paramam. And he says, Purusham Shashvatam, Divyam, Adidevam, Ajam, Vibhum. He says all of these observations he makes, and he says, Ahuhu Tvam. This is what is said about you, Rishaya Sarve, by the various sages, and he names a few sages. And then he says, not just that, Swayam cha eva, even you yourself, Bravishi me, have declared to me yourself. So Arjuna is saying that is, this is what all the sages tell about you, and this is what I have heard from you, and this is what I have come to understand too. If the sages say, then it may be an expression of their emotions, right? If a devotee says that, oh Lord, you're the greatest, you're this, you're that, it could be an expression of that person's emotion. It could be a devotional outpouring. But when Krishna himself says, it now has the authority of truth. But why is Arjuna saying all this? What is the point he's coming to? We'll go to the next shloka and we'll see what more Arjuna is saying.
Sarvametadrutam manye yanmam vadasi keshava nahite bhagavan vyaktim vidurdevana danavaha.
O Keshava, I accept to be true all this which you tell me. Certainly, O Lord, neither the gods nor the demons comprehend your glory. That's the 14th verse. He says, Sarvam metat, all this, yat mam vadasi Keshava, which you have told me, O Keshava, ritam manye, I consider them as ritam, the truth. Arjuna uses the word ritam. Ritam also means satya or truth. But when ritam and satya is used, or ritam is used in place of satya, the ritam stands for something little more profound. What is the difference between satyam and ritam? This is a very deep topic in itself, and it is spoken about in the Upanishads. I'm not going into the entire detail of it, but let's give a very simple understanding of the difference between satyam and ritam. Satya, as we saw when Krishna was talking about his vibhutis, was one of the qualities that he mentioned. He says, satya is one of my vibhutis. Satya is your ability to speak what you have seen or experienced as it is. Being truthful to the experience of the senses and the understanding of the mind is what is referred to as satya. But what I see may itself be an illusion, right? That's quite possible. It could be an optical illusion. The mind is quite capable of coming to wrong conclusions too. So what I speak can still be satyam, because I am being true to my understanding and my experience, but it need not necessarily be the absolute truth. And that is where the concept of ritam comes. Ritam is that which is the absolute truth, is not dependent on the person who is observing or speaking about it. It is not subject to any individual's experience. That is why Arjuna mentions the names of all these sages and jnanis, and he says they all have declared, which means that is the collective experience of all these people. I have also come to understand this, and above all, you yourself have also said it. So I do not consider this as satyam or merely satyam anymore. I consider this as ritam. Ritam manye. He says, sarvam etat yat mam vadasi Keshavaha. Whatever you have said to me, O Keshava, ritam manye. I consider this as ritam, the absolute truth. He, certainly, Bhagavan, O blessed Lord, te vyaktitam. Your persona, devaha na danavaha. Neither the devas nor the danavas or the demons, na viduhu, do not know. How can the danavas really know God? Right? Because he says, neither the demons nor the danavas know you. I'm sorry, neither the devas nor the danavas know you. Saying that even the devas don't know you is something like a praise of Lord Krishna. But even the danavas don't know you, because danavas or the demons are those whom we associate with ignorance, isn't it? I think Arjuna is just giving the whole spectrum from the lowest to the highest. No one knows you. And danavas also know God, if you really look at it. They recognize the nature of God as being quite opposite to their own. And that is why they dislike him, isn't it? The Kauravas knew very well Krishna, and that is why they despised him. They knew that he stands for dharma, and because they were not standing on the side of dharma, they looked at him as somebody who is inimical to them, right? But their knowledge of who God is also not complete. That's why he says, neither the devas nor the danavas know you completely. And then he continues, we'll go to the 15th shloka as well.
Swayamevatmanatmanam vethatvam purushottama bhuta bhavana bhutesha deva deva jagatpate.
O Supreme One, the Creator of beings, the Lord of all beings, God of all gods, the Lord of the worlds, you yourself alone know yourself by yourself. So that's the 15th verse, Arjuna's praise and summary of his understanding continue. And he makes a very beautiful statement. But before we come to that statement, let us see how he addresses Krishna with a few more appellations in the shloka, in the second line of the shloka to be precise. That again shows that Arjuna is understanding now the glory of Lord Krishna much better, right? Of course, they all looked up to Krishna as not being a mere human, even before the Bhagavad Gita was given, because they have experienced his vibhutis in that sense, right? His miracles. But did they really comprehend who Krishna was, the divine nature, this Paripurna Avatar that Krishna was? Maybe they did not comprehend then. That is why Arjuna is making all of these points. After listening to all that Krishna has said, he's saying that now I understand who you are. He says, Bhuta Bhavana, O source of beings, or creator of all. Bhutesha, O Isha, or Lord of Bhutas, or all the beings. Deva Deva, O God of gods. Jagatpate, O ruler of all the worlds, or the ruler of the world. Then comes this quite profound statement that he makes. Swayameva atmana atmanam veta tvam purushottama. He says, Swayameva atmana atmanam veta tvam purushottama. He says, O Purushottama, O Supreme One, Swayameva, you alone, Vetatvam, know yourself, Atmana Atmanam, the Self by the Self. The Self is known only by the glory of the Self itself, right? So that is the perfect definition of the Atma. So this statement that Arjuna expresses is a reflection of his deep comprehension of what Krishna is. Swayameva atmana atmanam veta tvam purushottama. No one knows you, only you know yourself. Your true self is known only to you as it is revealed to you and nobody else. It is the knowledge that comes from your own self. Everything that we comprehend is because of the self within. If there was no self within, there will not be consciousness, there will not be awareness, isn't it? It is, as we've given this analogy before, it is like the sunlight because of which everything is seen. And it is the sunlight because of which even the sun itself is seen. That is the nature of the Atma. It is through the light of the Atma, everything else is seen. And it is through the light of the Atma itself will be comprehended. Right? So that process or that concept of the self being known by the self is literally embodied by Lord Krishna. He says, Atmana Atmanam Vetattvam. You know yourself through the self, Swayameva, only you know it that way. A very beautiful, as I said, an explanation of his understanding of what, of who Krishna is. That's what he says. Everything that we comprehend is because of the self within. And you are that self. Krishna said, I become the Jnana Deepa in the mind of the worshipper. So the presence of the lamp is recognized by the light of the lamp itself, isn't it? So that Atma, which is known by itself, is represented by Krishna. And when Krishna said that I enlighten you by being in your mind, this is what it means, right? So it's a very beautiful description of Lord Krishna's nature that Arjuna is giving to show that I quite understand what you're telling. But what is the point of all this? Where is Arjuna driving all this to? Because till now, he's doing what we do at the end of the chapter. He's summarizing whatever Krishna has said so far. But what is the point? Where is it all leading to? So we'll listen to the next shloka as well, and we'll probably have a brief discussion on that before we conclude today. So we'll listen to the 16th shloka.
Vaktumarhasya sheshena divyahyatma vibhutayah yabhir vibhutibhir lokan imamstvam vyapyatishthasi.
Please tell me all about thy glorious manifestations without holding back, which are indeed divine, through which you exist pervading these worlds. So that's the 16th verse. So here slowly comes the question or the agenda behind all of these shlokas that Arjuna was saying. This is the point Krishna himself made at the beginning of the chapter itself, that I alone am capable of talking about my vibhutis, and hence, I will explain it to you myself. And Arjuna is making the same point and saying, so Krishna, now tell me more, right? Arjuna says, Vaktum arhasi. The word arhasi has two meanings, and based on that, the meaning of the shloka also changes. But the essence is pretty much the same. Arhasi means to be pleased. So Vaktum arhasi means, may you be pleased to tell me. In other words, please tell me, right? When we say, please do this for me, or please tell me, the archaic explanation of that is, may you be pleased to do this for me, or may you be pleased to tell me this. So, Vaktum Arhasi means, may you be pleased to tell me. So, if you take that meaning, that's what this shloka's first line means. The word Arhasi also means worthy or capable, right? Arhata, the word which we often use in other Indian languages, comes from this. Arhasi also means one who is capable or one who is worthy of that. So if you take that meaning, Vaktum Arhasi means only you are capable of telling, which is also true, right? Which is what Arjuna said in the previous verse as well. So he says, Vaktum Arhasi Asheshane. I'm sorry, Vaktum Arhasi Asheshana. only you are capable of telling me without leaving behind anything. Or please tell me without leaving out anything. Ashesha means entirely or without anything remaining, right? So vaktum arhasi asheshana means please tell me without leaving out anything. And what does he want to hear in this way, asheshana, entirely? He says, atma vibhutayaha, your glories, your vibhutis, atma vibhutayaha, I want to know about your vibhutis, divyaha hi, which are indeed divine, because I've recognized them as being divine. Atma vibhutayaha, divyaha hi, your verily divine vibhutis, yabihi vibhuti bihi, by which vibhutis, lokan iman, these worlds, tvam vyapya, you have pervaded, tishtasi, and thereby you exist. So that is Arjuna's plea or question. This is exactly what Krishna said in the beginning of the chapter. Only I am capable of talking about my vibhutis, so I am going to tell you about my vibhutis. And he also did. The same thing Arjuna is telling here, O Krishna, only you are capable of talking about your glories. The devas and danavas are not capable. And he says that I do agree with whatever has been explained by you, because that is my understanding and that is the understanding of all these rishis. So I consider that as ritam, but I am not satisfied. Tell me more, right? That's the essence of what Arjuna is saying. Yabihi vibhuti bihi lokan iman tvam vyapya tishtasi. The analogy that we gave about the vibhum and the vibhuti, right? Vibhu is a name for the Lord. The word vibhum also means the omnipresent. We came across that in one of the shlokas that we covered just today. Vibhum means the omnipresent Lord. How is the vibhu omnipresent? It is through these vibhutis. The sun is present everywhere through the sun rays that penetrate into every space, isn't it? Right? So in that sense, the vibhu, the Lord, becomes omnipresent and is recognizable as being omnipresent through these vibhutis. And that's what Arjuna is saying. Atma vibhutaya, your vibhutis, yabi vibhuti bihi, because of those vibhutis, lokan iman tvam vyapya tishtasi, you exist all pervading in these lokas. Tell me more about it. Why? He says, vaktum arhasi, only you are capable of telling, or please tell me. As I said, both meanings apply to that word. So that is the supplication that Arjuna is making before Krishna. And I think there is one or two more verses before Krishna starts replying. So in essence, what Arjuna is asking is, you have told me so many things about yourself, and because of that, I've come to understand all these about you. Now, having received all this, I am not satisfied. I want to listen more. And that is what Krishna is going to do in the rest of the chapter. So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode of the Gita series. Thank you for joining me. Do join me again next week at 10 a.m. for the resumption of this series. I'm going to play an old file for the afternoon satsang, so I'm not going to come back at 12 o'clock to meet you. That'll be a rebroadcast of an earlier program, but I do hope you'll enjoy it as a refresher of whatever we've spoken sometime back. I'll meet you all again next week as part of the Gita series. Till then, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.